I've been asked to tell you that the following show is very scary, with stuff that might give your kids nightmares. You see, there are some crybabies out there, religious types mostly, who might be offended. If you are one of them, I advise you to turn off your set now. Come on, I dare you. Chicken! Hey.
People are literally doing the shark, a dance craze that's number one with a bullet to the head.
We have some breaking news to pass along to you. The Sharknado Prediction Center has just issued a high risk of sharknados tonight. And you have to keep in mind that sharknados are usually accompanied by very heavy rain. You're also looking at some extensive winds and panicked bystanders. So if you live in the area, please be cautious. We take a look at the hour-by-hour Sharknado forecast. Looks like all the ingredients coming together for a possible Sharknado at its worst right around that 10 p.m. time frame.
Stay away from the storm. Please do not confront, aggravate, fight, pet, or feed the shark.
Winds are currently at 50 knots an hour. You're going to want to hold on to your budgie smugglers.
I hope you're ready to rock, boy.
It's a shark!
Listening to the Casey Ferguson Show's Haunted House of Rock on Everest Island Radio 92.1 FM.
Yeah. and crawling, knocking and rocking. You are listening to the Casey Ferguson Show's Haunted House of Rock on Amherst Island Radio 92.1 FM.
Don't let him in. Last time he ate the sofa.
That's right, the program you crave is back from the grave. It's Casey Ferguson here, the boogeyman of the broadcast world, impaling the airwaves at 92.1 FM for the first time in nearly a year. And while I won't make any promises as to future episodes on this station, I will make a few in regards to this one. I promise you a heaping helping of ear candy, sure to blow the tweeters of you trick-or-treaters. As if the Razor's Edge by AC/DC didn't do just that.
My ovaries.
I promise an in-depth interview with Thunder Levin, the writer of Sharknado, and enough bone-crunching tunes from the likes of Megadeth, Crazy Licks, and Seasons After to put a sumptuous sag in your trick-or-treat bag. So put on your masks and fill your flasks. This is Electric Frankenstein on the Haunted House of Rock. Born and bred to rip and shred, you are listening to the Casey Ferguson Show's Haunted House of Rock on Amherst Island Radio 92.1 FM.
Why don't you dress up as Lady Gorilla or something pretty like that?
From Friday the 13th, The Game, that was Crazy Licks XIII, before that was Megadeth Public Enemy No. 1, and kicking off that trifecta of terror tunes was Electric Frankenstein with Demolition Joyride. My guest on this episode of the Casey Ferguson Show is writer-director Thunder Levin.
Hey! It's you! McMuffin!
Thunder is best known as the writer of the film Sharknado, but in fact he also wrote the first three sequels for the franchise as well. Thunder has also directed films such as American Warships and Mutant Vampire Zombies from the Hood, starring the likes of Carl Weathers and C. Thomas Howell. That's Apollo Creed and Ponyboy to all you kids up past your bedtime.
All right, where is he?
He'll be here.
I hope so. I have my reputation to think of, you know.
Thunder will discuss going from years of struggling to break into Hollywood to Good Morning America, and stars such as Matt Damon and Mark Wahlberg tweeting about his film, how he came to watch dailies for The Hunt for Red October on set with director John McTiernan, what he's working on now, and the challenges of writing so many incredible cameos into the Sharknado series. This is my conversation with writer-director Thunder Levin on the Casey Ferguson Show's Haunted House of Rock. All right, this is Casey Ferguson, and you're listening to the Casey Ferguson Show. Usually it's metaphorical when I say the thunder's coming, but this time it's literal. Here comes the thunder. Writer and director Thunder Levin is on the phone. Welcome to the show, mister.
Thanks for having me, Casey.
Glad to do it. What's happening on this Friday night for you? Are you wrestling with the written word, or are you done for the day?
I am still working on my latest script. It's a science fiction script called Star Child, which I am co-writing with novelist Rebecca Cantrell. And soon I'll be heading out to the movies to see Nicolas Cage's new film, Mandy.
Outstanding. Well, I guess that's a different project from... I know you had a sci-fi thing you were working on for... I think you were doing research for it for like 7 years or something. Are you still working on that?
Yes. That's something that I'm not really talking about right now because we're actually trying to make something happen with it. And I don't want to jinx it.
Fair enough. Well, bringing it up on this show especially, we don't want that effect in things. So I'll take another tactic here. Since we're talking about sci-fi, how different would your life have been if your mom had told you to get your ass to bed instead of watching Star Trek?
Yeah. So you've read up on me. Yeah, that was a formative experience, I think, when I was little. Star Trek was the one show my mom let me stay up late to watch. Gosh, I don't know. I think my life might well have been very different indeed, because that was sort of the beginning of it all. Was that show sort of sparked my imagination, and I was a big Star Trek fan. And then someone gave me a book called The Making of Star Trek, which was it was way too dry for a little kid. So I turned to the pictures section, and right there in the pictures section is a shot of these studio technicians in their 60s work clothes working on the bridge of the Enterprise. And something clicked in my mind that said, there is a way I can work on the Enterprise. That's sort of where the very first inkling of being in this business came from.
Well, Thunder, I'm a big fan of the do-it-yourself approach and creating your own opportunities. I mean, I didn't like radio, so I made my own show, you know?
There you go.
Yeah, so, you know, I've heard you say in the past that, you know, you got sick of the Hollywood runaround, having deals that would fall through at the last minute, and decided after years of that, you were going to raise your own money and make your own movie, which was, I guess, Mutant Vampire Zombies from the Hood, right?
You guessed correctly. I'd been at this the Hollywood grind for a long time. I had scripts optioned and never produced. I had independent film deals that seemed like they were done and we were going into production, and then they'd fall apart. And that went on for years. And finally I just said, to hell with it. Let's raise some money and make our own film. What actually happened was it was another deal that fell apart, though, in a tragic way. A Northern California filmmaker named Roger Saunders had been putting together a financing package that he'd been telling me about for several years. And it looked like it was finally a done deal. The contracts had been all drawn up with his investors. He was going to be transforming some old warehouses near San Francisco into sound stages. and he was going to be making a slate of relatively low-budget films, and he asked me to write him an urban horror film, and that would be the first one we would do. And he was to produce it, and I would write and direct it. And so I got together with my collaborator, George Saunders, and we wrote this script in very short order, and I sent it to Roger, and he said, great, as soon as everything is signed, sealed, and delivered, this will be the first film we do. And weeks went by, and I didn't hear from him, and I'd send an email, I'd leave a message. Finally, after a couple of months, I called him at home, and his wife answers the phone, and she tells me that Roger has died.
Oh, no.
He had a heart attack. He had a previously undiagnosed heart defect, and he was a big, strong guy. It looked like he could have been a football player, a linebacker. And just one day out of nowhere, it hit him, and it was over. And I called my collaborator that day and said, we've got to make this movie ourselves because we could die. And he agreed with me. And so we did. I had tried to raise money like a year or two before for a film and hadn't gotten nearly as much as I needed. So I had the sort of the template of for all the paperwork and how to put the business plan together and everything. And this time, some of the investors I went to remembered me from before, and even though that first project hadn't gone, they, I guess, were now more familiar with me and more comfortable with me, and so they invested a bit more, and we found some new people, and bit by bit, it took us about a year, but we put the money together, $165,000, and we cast C. Thomas Howell, and we went off and made Mutant Vampire Zombies from the Hood, and we shot it in 12 days, all in on location in the hood, as it says in the credits, in like South Central LA and Compton and stuff. And that was sort of the kickstart that I needed. And then that film, you know, I knew this. I had a mutual friend, friend of a friend rather, named David Latt, who was one of the partners in a production company called The Asylum. And I'd been telling him for years he should hire me to write and direct a film, and he'd never really taken me seriously. But now that I had this film I could show him, I said, look, I can do this. See? Everything I've been telling you for years is true. And he couldn't deny it, because here was a finished film with a name star. It was done fairly well for the budget. And at the time, it was even lower budgets than The Asylum was working on. And so they hired me to write a film called 200 Miles Per Hour, which led to me writing and directing a film called American Warships, which in turn led me to turn down a movie called Shark Storm from them, because did we really need another movie with sharks and a storm? There's no way on their budgets we could possibly do justice to a movie about a shark attack in a huge storm and play it straight. That just wouldn't work.
Well, we all know how that ended up.
Yeah, so like a month later they came back to me and they said, forget about Shark Storm, now it's Sharknado. And I said, what do sharks have to do with the North Atlantic Treaty Organization? And they said, no. Sharknado, a tornado of sharks.
I get it.
And I said, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of. And as long as I can write it that way, I'm in. They said, yeah, we recognize that a movie called Sharknado has to be a bit ridiculous. And the rest is history.
Well, I'll certainly get to Sharknado. I know there's probably a bunch of the listeners chomping at the bit that want me to get to that right away, but we'll get there. Going back to the, you know, the zombies from the hood and, you know, and that whole approach, I mean, it certainly takes guts to do things that way, but, you know, from what I can deduce, Thunder, you were never short on courage, because, I mean, hell, you called up John McTiernan's office, right? You ended up sitting in on dailies for Hunt for Red October, correct?
Yeah, you've been watching my videos. Yeah, I told that story on Film Courage did this long interview with me. Yeah, so one of the things I was doing to try and break in early on was I would just cold call companies that had made films that I liked and say, hey, I'm a graduate of the NYU Film School. I'd like you to take a look at my student film. And I was also doing it occasionally with filmmakers whose work I liked. And John McTiernan had just done Die Hard and before that Predator, which I thought were two brilliant films. And so I just called up his office and asked to speak to him. And of course, I never got to John McTiernan himself, but his assistant, you know, took my information, said, sure, send me your film, I'll take a look. And it took a while. You know, I had to keep following up, and I was persistent without being annoying, I hope. And eventually she said, why don't you come in and talk to me? And so I went in, and we had a meeting, and it was right around lunchtime, and so they were viewing dailies for Red October, and she said, why don't you sit in on dailies? And I did, and sat right next to McTiernan as he watched dailies, and I hoped to get to talk to him, but that never happened, because as soon as dailies were over, he had to rush back to the set. But it established a good relationship with his assistant, who really, she was really more of his business partner. She ran his company. And so that connection eventually led me, she actually referred me to a producer who referred me to another producer who hired me for my first professional gig.
Well, it's funny how it works. I mean, you've said something in the past that, you know, I think a lot of people forget about, you know, take the meeting, have lunch, even if you don't know that the other person is interested or in the market, because down the line, they just may very well be, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's an old cliche, so I mean, I don't think nobody's thought of it. It's that, you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know in Hollywood. And that, sadly, is true to a certain extent. I mean, you've got to know what you're doing as well, or you're not going to impress these people. But there are an awful lot of very talented people knocking on the door of Hollywood who simply can't get in. The difference is either you knock the door down or you make friends with people behind the door. And I've sort of done a little of both, I guess. But those relationships are key. I mean, that's really how the business works.
Well, I guess what I mean by that is just that, you know, certainly not that people hadn't thought of it before, but I think a lot of young up-and-coming filmmakers or, you know, maybe people who've been kicking around for a bit sort of forget that it's not always about that immediate, yes, we'll do your film or this or that. Go out. Like networking is so important. And I know, you know, I don't like going out and selling myself either. I mean, I was the lead singer and obviously now something of a radio personality. So I've got the gift of gab. I can turn it on if I want to, but I really seldom want to unless I'm doing this show or something, you know? So going out and like sitting down with somebody and bullshitting or whatever isn't always, you know, something I want to do, but it is kind of something you have to do. You know, I would like to just tell people, hey man, just listen to the show. If you want to advertise, like check the show out and let me know if you think I got something and then we can have a conversation. Right. But you can't always do it that way. You kind of gotta sit down and shoot the breeze and establish a relationship so that maybe at some point they would be in the market looking to advertise or somebody would be looking to make a certain kind of film and they think of you, right?
Right. I mean, we all want the work to speak for itself. And most creative people, or at least a lot of creative people, you know, behind the scenes are very uncomfortable trying to sell themselves. But it really is the way to make it work, and you never know what connection is going to be the one. I mean, you know, when I wrote Sharknado, I thought it could well be the end of my career. At one point, I considered taking my name off it. But, you know, I mean, that just goes to show you never know. You never know what it's going to be, and so you got to take advantage of every opportunity that presents itself.
Absolutely. Well, before I move on to Sharknado, I certainly wanted to ask you about directing Carl Weathers in American Warships and C. Thomas Howell, of course. I mean, two guys, you know, pretty iconic in certain roles, you know, Carl with Apollo Creed, of course, and C. Thomas Howell, Pony Boy, and The Outsiders. I mean, what was it like to direct these guys? Because I would think a bit surreal just watching them in so many of these films, right?
Yeah, I mean, they were two very different experiences. Tommy, C. Thomas Howell, takes his craft very seriously. He's I don't know if he's quite a method actor, but he's very interested in every little nuance, and he's always thinking, and that can be a bit challenging for a director, because when an actor has their own ideas and it's not exactly the same as what you had in mind, you got to figure out how you're going to work with them. So Tommy was always very serious about his craft, and we had to figure out a good way to work together, and fortunately we did. With Carl Weathers, it was actually a very simple, very lovely experience. He's a really nice guy, and he came in, and we shot all his material in one day. He came in, and we did the thing. He was sort of the consummate professional. He did what I asked. Every once in a while, he had an idea of his own, and we would fit that in. And it was just a really a lovely day. The thing I remember most about Carl was actually the first time I spoke to him. I was on location in North Carolina. We'd already been scouting locations and doing pre-production, but we hadn't started shooting yet. And we were on Thanksgiving break, and I was driving up to Virginia to spend the weekend with some friends who lived there. And they told me that they'd finalized the deal with Carl Weathers, the producers told me, and that he was going to give me a call at some point. So I'm driving, it's like 4 hours on the road to Virginia, and I get this call, and there's this really deep voice. I'm not going to be able to do it justice, but he just came on the phone. He said, "This is Carl Weathers for Thunder 11." And it was like a chill went down my spine because it was Apollo Creed. And I just couldn't believe it. And it was just so great. I mean, we had a nice chat while I was driving. And then when he showed up on set, it was just great. He was, I would describe him as a perfect gentleman. I remember he had his own combat boots. And we had a scene where he would be jogging. He plays a general in the army, in the Pentagon, in the film. But we had a scene where he was off duty and he was jogging, and you know, we figured we'd get him some nice sneakers or something. And he's like, "No, I've got these combat boots. I think that would be better." And so he did this whole jogging scene up and down the street in Wilmington, North Carolina, which now today it's ironic. I'm watching it on the news, and they're like underwater. But yeah, that's one of the things I remember. Is he had his own combat boots that he wanted to jog in.
Well, that's somewhat method, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, I'm sure the listeners are starting to do backflips here. They want me to get at the Sharknado stuff, so I guess we might as well dive into that little movie you did, I guess there was four of them that you worked on, but I know you've said that it was just the most surreal experience of your life, you know, the night that the movie came out, and then, you know, tons of interviews are coming in. 2 days later, you're shooting a segment for Good Morning America, and Matt Damon and Mark Wahlberg are tweeting about the film. It really was quite a phenomenon. I'm kind of curious about how people's attitudes around you might have changed, or their perception of you. Did you have a lot of people flip-flopping or offering you things, or treating you differently right away?
Yeah, it was overnight.
Wow, that's good.
It was literally overnight that I went from this struggling wannabe filmmaker, even though I had made several movies, to often known Hollywood commodity, but to somebody who was in the business, to somebody who required being spoken to as a fellow professional. And it literally happened overnight.
Well, they'd actually return your calls, right?
Yeah. So people would return my calls, they would take meetings with me, and they would talk to me like I was, you know, one of them. And it was refreshing because I've been working towards it for 20 years. But to think that came from this crazy little shark movie I wrote is really kind of surreal.
Yeah, it's kind of a bizarre way in, but I mean, hey, whatever gets you there, I suppose, right?
Yep, absolutely. You never know.
I would think that there would be a lot of challenges in writing the cameos. Just, I know that people were being recruited all through production and whatnot, so I would think that would just wreak havoc in the writing process. What was the process for that?
The process for that was every conceivable process and then some. There were certain cameos that I would write just in the initial drafts that we knew we would plug somebody into. And then there were times where I would write a cameo and then they would say, "Hey, we got this person. You need to change it completely." And that would have to happen very quickly. And sometimes they would get somebody and there would be no cameo for them and we would have to write something. We'd have to come up with something on short notice. And there were times when people would show up on set sort of without warning because they'd been cast the night before and we'd have to invent material for them. On Sharknado 3, we had a day where we were shooting at our military base and we had two actors show up for one role.
Oh, no.
And, you know, the asylum casting department had just been in overdrive trying to get whoever, you know, whatever celebrity cameos they could arrange. And they sent us two guys for one part. And so I'm on the set we're out in the, it's this ranch, this movie ranch, outside of LA. And we're just out there, and there's like hills and Humvees, and it was dressed up as a military set, but there were no offices or anything to work in. And we weren't even by our, by the trailers that we had set up, as a working space, because we were out shooting. And, I had to come up with a way to divide this part into two, but it wasn't that big a part. It was just one cameo. And so I ended up having to sort of expand and divide it into two different people. And I ended up, I had my dog on the set that day because he was doing a cameo as a military dog on the military base. And I call him over and I just tell him to stay. And I put the back of the script on his back and I used him as a desk. And I started writing out dialogue. there was every conceivable way of dealing with the cameos, and some of them were crazier than others. One of the ones I enjoyed the most was they were able to tell me ahead of time on, I guess it was the third one, that we were getting Penn and Teller, and I thought, great, I can finally write a joke, right? I've got this great comedy team. Sharknado is this very funny movie series, but there are no actual jokes in it. So I felt like, great, I could finally write a joke and they won't be able to say no. And so I wrote what I thought was a very clever joke because they're supposed to be playing retired astronauts. And it was, one of them was saying, it was something about Neil Armstrong, and you know how serious Neil could be. And so he just turns to him and he says, well, sure, Buzz, but it'll still look good on your resume. So I mean, that was like the one time I actually got to write a joke for Sharknado. Yeah, it was great. And you know, sometimes you would have these incredible people show up that you didn't even know they were going to cast, and they were even better than who you thought you might be writing the part for. I mean, when we wrote on the second one, we had this airplane scene where we needed these two pilots, and we were doing an homage to Twilight Zone, to the famous episode that William Shatner was in the TV show, and then John Lithgow did the same part in the Twilight Zone movie. And we thought, okay, let's get William Shatner and John Lithgow to play the pilot and co-pilot. And that's how I wrote the part. And then we couldn't get either of them, but they got Robert Hayes from Airplane to play the pilot, which was even more brilliant. Because we were also doing an airplane homage. And then, of course, I had no idea who was going to play the taxi driver in the second one. And when they told me that
Jed Hirsch,
yes, from Taxi, was going to play the taxi driver, that was just the most brilliant thing I'd ever heard of. I mean, that just made my day. I mean, made the whole shoot for me that we had Jed Hirsch playing a taxi driver. So, I mean, yeah, there were some great things involved in the cameos. And then as the series progressed, they got more and more cameos that I'd never heard of. So, it got kind of crazy how far they would go for these cameos eventually.
Yeah, true story. It seemed like everybody and their dog was showing up eventually.
Yeah, well, me and my dog showed up. So, that's true.
See what I did there?
Yeah.
Well, now I hope I'm not opening a can of worms here, but why didn't you write 5 and 6?
I mean, after 4, to be honest, after 3, I felt like we had told our story. We had completed the trilogy. We had brought everything full circle. Finn had his family back. He had a new son. It sounds silly to speak this seriously of Sharknado, but it was, underneath all the craziness, it was also a story of a broken man redeeming himself. And I felt like by the end of the third one, we had accomplished that. And so that story was done. And at that point, I wondered about moving on. But it seemed to make sense to do the fourth one. I don't know. There was, after 4, I felt like we should have been exploring new ground, and we didn't really. It just seemed like it was time to move on. I had another project that ended up, I mean, the way it really happened is that I had a scheduling conflict, and I was writing this other movie, and then that movie got postponed, but by then I had already made the decision. And I think the Asylum was ready to move on because they had to keep paying me more for each movie than the previous one.
Yeah, I don't like doing that.
The Asylum doesn't like to do that. And so I think it all worked. out for the best. And I liked some of the things they did in this last one, that to wrap up the series. But I think I would have done myself. So I have no regrets in that regard.
So you were happy with how things ended up then?
Yeah, I mean, I was even in the final scene of number six. So, yeah, I think Anthony guided the ship to a safe harbor, and I liked where it ended up. I mean, I look at five, and I look at, let's say, the first half of six and say, well, I wouldn't have done things quite that way. But I liked the way it all wrapped up, and I think they did a good job.
Well, as long as that closure's there, you know, I mean, I suppose, you know, you would be so attached to it. It's sort of your baby, so I'm glad that...
Yeah.
You know, it turned out that way, because you hear all kinds of stories about guys that were involved with, you know, even a guy like Wes Craven, right, who did Nightmare on Elm Street, and then it just went in such a different direction. He was really disappointed with some of the turns that it had taken. So I'm happy that it worked out that way, and that, you know, you were able to have that, because some directors certainly just go, oh, man, I wish he wouldn't have done that.
Yeah, I mean, it might have been worse if I'd been directing as well as writing, but since I was just writing, already, you know, the finished movie never looked exactly the way I saw it in my head when I wrote it, because that's inevitable when someone else is directing. So that gives you a little bit of an emotional buffer, I think, which helped. But, I mean, I think it was George Lucas, or maybe it was Aaron Sorkin, I forget which one, who said that they didn't, that watching these movies after they were done was like watching your ex-wife make love to her new husband.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, and so there is some truth to that. But I like the way they wrapped it up, so I'm okay with it.
Speaking of wrapping things up, I suppose I should get doing that myself here. Since we got Halloween coming up, what do you plan on watching this Halloween, or maybe listening to? Are you going to get out the old Alice Cooper records, or what's happening over at the Levin household?
It's a good question. Just today I got invited to a party, so I think I will be going to that, and I think I will go see the new Halloween movie, since Jamie Lee Curtis is back. And I don't know. We'll just have to see what the night brings.
Outstanding. Well, anything else you want to bring to the listeners' attention?
Not really. I mean, we're going to be working on two projects right now. One is a serious science fiction film called Star Child, which I was just working on the script, and I realized it was time to speak with you. That hopefully will be something that we will get going next year. I'm also looking at a project which is more Sharknado-esque, called Deadbeard, the zombie pirate rock opera.
Oh, I like the sounds of that.
Yeah. And we might end up doing a crowdfunding campaign on Kickstarter or Indiegogo, depending on how some meetings I have in the next couple of weeks turn out. So maybe that'll be something that folks could look for and maybe help us get that made.
Well, by all means, Thunder, make sure, you know, I know what's going on. We can post things up on the Casey Ferguson Show Facebook or website or this or that, try to direct people to check this thing out.
Right, I'll let you know.
Outstanding. Well, thanks very much for your time, sir. You have a happy Halloween, and all the best of luck with your future projects here.
Thanks a lot.
Part talk show, part rock show. You are listening to the Casey Ferguson Show's Haunted House of Rock on Amherst Island Radio 92.1 FM.
If anybody wants me, I'll be upstairs dead by my own hand.
That was my conversation with writer-director Thunder Levin. You can keep up with Thunder on Facebook at Thunder Levin Official and on Twitter at Thunder Levin. Less blabbing, more stabbing. This is Seasons After on the Casey Ferguson Show's Haunted House of Rock.
Black house will rock. Black Welcome to the Manly Minute. I'm Dan Manly. On January 15th, 1919 in Boston, a storage tank ruptured, dosing the immediate area with a 30-foot-tall wave of molasses that killed 21 people. Well, so much for that saying. The Manly Minute might not be a full minute, but it's close enough to satisfy me.
This is R.A. Mihailov, Leatherface from Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3. You're listening to the Casey Ferguson Show. Happy Halloween.
We'll be right back.
slicing and dicing, stabbing and slabbing. You are listening to the Casey Ferguson Show's Haunted House of Rock on Emerst Island Radio 92.1 FM.
I'm cold and there are wolves after me.
The Sisters of Mercy there, Lucretia, My Reflection, and before that was Seasons After with their rendition of Cry Little Sister, written by a past guest of the Casey Ferguson Show, Gerard McMahon, a.k.a. G. Tom Mack, for the Lost Boys soundtrack. A film I'm very much fond of, and speaking of things I'm fond of, I hope you got to see the Sharknado promo poster J-Bird Digital Arts made for me, whether it was on social media or CaseyFergusonShow.com.
Excellent!
Yes, old Jay did a kick-ass job as per usual for me, and he'll do the same for you. So let me tell you about this cat. After all, Jaber Digital Arts is the exclusive sponsor of the Casey Ferguson Show's Haunted House of Rock. Your brand is important to you, and Jaber Digital Arts has been building brand identities for events, bands, venues, and companies in Eastern Ontario for years. They listen first and then take your imaging to the next level with a combination of sketching, scanning, photography, and Photoshop. Contact them directly to discuss your needs, and always be sure to let them know what kind of budget you have. They can always do something within your budget. You can find all their contact information and check out their portfolio at jbirddigitalarts.com. You can't afford to have good-looking stuff. You can't afford not to. Jaybird Digital Arts has been a long-time sponsor of the Casey Ferguson Show podcast, and I'm happy to have them on board with me here at 92.1 FM, so I hope you show them some loving.
You can do it!
Well, Maniacs, Doug McFly, the fattest fly in 666 cemeteries, is back at Motel Ferguson, and he's been in the washroom getting his costume together for what seems like an eternity at this point. Moments ago, he informed me he's ready. All right, Doug, it's time for the big reveal. Come on out. All right, I see a tie, and one hand a beer, and the other a dollar, a stupid look on Doug's face. Oh, wow. Doug McFly dresses as Doug Ford. That's a humdinger. Doug, I find it interesting that out of all the things you could dress up as, you picked a big fat idiot. What do you mean he's not that fat? Doug Ford is so fat, when Dracula sucked his blood, he got diabetes.
That's right. I said it. I meant it. I'm here to represent it.
Hold my beer and watch this, he says. Those are famous last words, Doug. This goes awry. I'll make sure that goes on your tombstone. All right, let's see what you got. All right, folks, I'm watching as my roommate and confidant, Doug McFly, has liftoff. He's hovering slightly above the floor, flying with all the might his oversized ass can muster. He's spinning around. He's picking up speed. Oh my! Oh my, it's a... Doug Nato! Are you okay, Doug? Oh, man. Well, maybe next time you should try it sober. Of course, the same thing could be said of the Fords.
Sure thing, giant beer!
Well, Doug and I have a pumpkin to carve, so we'll bid you farewell. If you enjoyed what you heard tonight, be sure to check out my podcast at CaseyFergusonShow.com and hit me with a like on Facebook at The Casey Ferguson Show. If you didn't like the show, go suck a candy corn. The Replacements will play us out with their rendition of the Kiss classic Black Diamond. Remember, it's only an island if you look at it from the water. Happy Halloween, everyone. Until next time, this is Casey Ferguson and Doug McFly. Over and out.
Out on the street for a living, you know it's only begun. They've got you under their thumb.